We're going to continue today in Judges chapter 9, which is the story of Abimelech, known more as Abimelech in English. This is the son of Gideon, but he was born of a Shechemite concubine. I want to briefly review. Gideon had 70 sons by his legal wives, possibly as many as 70 legal wives, and one son by a Canaanite woman from the city of Shechem. This meant that Gideon became a very wealthy man, and he lived a kingly lifestyle. Gideon's 70 legal wives were Hebrew women. His concubine, Abimelech's mother, was this exception. As Abimelech matured, he became brutally ambitious. He wanted to begin his own kingdom, so he strategized and decided the best place to start was with the ethnically mixed city of Shechem, his mother's family's hometown. Now, Shechem was a city that called Baal its god. There was a temple of Baal built there, and both the Canaanites and the Hebrews who lived in Shechem bowed down to this god. And Abimelech convinced his mother's family to back him in approaching the townspeople with a proposition, "Let me be your king." They agreed. And the underlying reasoning was that Abimelech appealed to both major ethnic groups, since he was half Canaanite, half Hebrew. Well, this step of his plan accomplished, Abimelech took the Machiavellian approach to obtaining and maintaining his hope for power and authority by hiring some thugs from Shechem to help him murder all 70 of his brothers. However, one brother, the youngest, escaped the slaughter. The surviving son of Gideon was named Jotham. Jotham is the usual English rendering. And Jotham found out that the people of Shechem intended on crowning Abimelech as their king. So he climbed up to the top of Mount Gerizim that overlooked the city, and he shouted out this prophetic parable that was a warning to these naive citizens. And this parable consisted of the story of a forest of trees representing a group of people that were looking for a king to rule over them. And the trees approached an olive tree who refused the offer, then a fig tree who refused, then a grapevine who did the same, and each had the same reason for their refusal of what seemed like such an amazing honor and a raising of their status. God created them for their own special purpose. They were each bearing the fruits of that purpose, and to abandon that divine purpose merely to rule over some trees, that was a misuse of their God-ordained gifts. So as a last resort, these trees approached the loathsome bramble, a sticker bush that grew on the soil like a carpet lays on a floor. It was very low to the ground. A bramble's nothing but a menace, serves no good use at all. So the bramble, of course, jumps at this opportunity to rule over these mighty trees. But he adds a not-so-subtle warning that he expects the trees to fully submit to him and to fully depend upon his goodness and mercy as he sees fit. And if the trees do not submit, well, then the bramble will destroy the trees. Jotham then ended his parable with a curse. As a result of Abimelech's murder of all of Gideon's sons, God will intervene. And he will cause Abimelech to destroy the people of Shechem, and the people of Shechem will do the same to him. Well, after 3 years under Abimelech's selfish and oppressive rule, the people of Shechem had enough, and friction between them and their king was reaching a point of combustion. We'll continue from there. So let's reread Judges chapter 9, starting at verse 22. Judges chapter 9, starting at verse 22. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is page 282. 282, if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Judges chapter 9, starting with verse 22. Abimelech was a chief over Israel for 3 years. But God sent a spirit of discord between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, so that the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. This came about so that the crime against the 70 sons of Yerubbaal might be avenged, and the responsibility for their bloody death be placed on Abimelech, their brother, who murdered them, and on the men of Shechem who helped him kill his brothers. So the men of Shechem sent out men to ambush him on the mountaintops, and they robbed everyone who went past them, and Abimelech was told about it. Gaal, the son of a slave, came with his brothers and went on to Shechem, and the men of Shechem put their trust in him. They went out into the field, gathered their grapes, and pressed the juice out of them. Then they held a feast and went into the house of their god to eat and drink, and there they insulted Abimelech. Gaal, the son of a slave, said, "Who is Abimelech? Think of the contrast with Shechem. Why should we serve Abimelech? Isn't he the son of Yerubbaal? Isn't Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem. Why should we serve Abimelech? If I were in control of this people, I'd get rid of Abimelech." Then addressing his words to Abimelech, he said, "Come out and fight. I don't care if you make your army even larger." Well, when Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of a slave, he was enraged. And he sent messengers to Abimelech in Tormah with this message: "Gaal, the son of a slave, and his brothers have come to Shechem, and they're inciting the city against you. You and the men with you should come up now at night and lie in wait in the field. In the morning, get up early as soon as the sun rises and attack the city. Then when Gaal and the men with him come out to fight you, do whatever you can to them." Abimelech and all the men with him came up by night. They lay in wait against Shechem in four groups. Gaal, the son of a slave, went out, stationed himself at the entrance to the city gate. Then Abimelech and his men arose from their ambush. And when Gaal saw the men, he said to Zebul, "Look, there are men coming down from the mountaintops." But Zebul answered, "You're seeing the shadows of the mountains as if they were men." And Gaal said again, "Look, there are men coming down from the main hill in the land. And one group is coming out on the road from the fortune teller's oak." And Zebul said to him, "Where is your mouth now? You said, 'Who's Abimelech? Why should we serve him? Aren't these the people you despise? Go on, fight them.'" So Gaal went out, leading the men of Shechem, and they fought Abimelech. But Abimelech gave chase, and Gaal took to flight, and many fell wounded, strewn all along the way to the city gate. Then Abimelech took up residence in Arumah, and Zebul drove out Gaal and his brothers so that they could not live in Shechem. But the very next day, the people went out into the field, and Abimelech was told about it. He took his men, divided them into three groups, and lay in wait in the field. And when he saw the people going out of the city, he came out of hiding and slaughtered them. Abimelech and his group rushed forward and occupied the entrance to the city gate, while the other two groups attacked all those in the field and killed them. Abimelech fought against the city all that day. He captured it, killed its people, destroyed its buildings, and sowed its land with salt. When all the men in the fortress of Shechem heard about this, they took refuge in the stronghold of the temple of Baal-berith. Abimelech was told that all the men from Shechem, from the Shechem fortress, had gathered there. So he led all of his men up to Mount Salmon, where he took an axe in his hand. He cut off a branch of a tree and laid it on his shoulder. And he said to those with him, "Quick, do just what you saw me do." They all did likewise, each man cutting off a branch, and they followed Abimelech, and they put the branches up against the stronghold and set them on fire, burned down the stronghold, so that all the people from the Shechem fortress died, about 1,000 men and women. Then Abimelech went to Tevetz, set up a camp against Tevetz, and captured it. But there was a fortified tower inside the city, and all the men and women took refuge in it, everyone in the city. They shut themselves inside and went up into the roof of the tower. However, Abimelech approached the tower and attacked it, and then it came up close to the tower's door in order to burn it down. But a woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head, cracking his skull. He quickly called out to the young man holding his armor, "Draw your sword and finish me off so that people won't say a woman killed me." So his attendant ran him through, and he died. When the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they all went back home. This is how God paid back Abimelech for the wrong he did to his father in murdering his 70 brothers. God also repaid the men of Shechem for all the wrong they had done. On them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. You know, I think it's fitting that as we look at the serious and deteriorating matters facing the United States, I mean, from rampant immorality to financial distress to fighting interminable wars, it seems like, on foreign soil, here we are studying the book of Judges, which has as its root the issue of national leadership. And we couple it with the desire of most citizens to go their own way without regard to what's right and what's wrong. Now, up to chapter 9, we saw that the problem for Israel was not just a lack of leadership, but also a lack of leaders. What few leaders they had didn't lead. They just mostly enjoyed the benefits of their position, most of which the leaders obtained by birthright, not by their merit. So the essentially leaderless Israelites would follow their own human nature, which was invariably to pull away from Jehovah and his commandments and to adopt the sensually attractive gods and customs of their neighbors. So in response, God would send some foreign nation to oppress Israel. Then Israel would call to God for help. Finally, the Lord would raise up a shofet, a judge, to deliver Israel from their oppression. And finally, that judge would rule over Israel for a time. Well, the various judges, all of them God appointed, generally provided godly, albeit imperfect, leadership over Israel for some number of years, during which time Israel prospered and enjoyed peace. But here in Judges 9, Israel, actually just a small portion of Israel, found itself under some satanically inspired leadership, and we're reading about how that happens and the inevitable results. Abimelech was not God's chosen leader for Israel. So Gideon's sole remaining son used his own cunning and his violent ambitions to achieve power. And in this, we learn some valuable lessons about leadership, especially as regards ruling over a nation. It's interesting that Abimelech knew he could not force himself upon the people of Shechem. Instead, he had to convince them to choose him. Abimelech didn't march into Shechem with an army and take the city. He didn't threaten the city with violence if they refused. Rather, he asked the people to make him their king because he convinced them it would be to their benefit. He made promises to them. Sounded very good to their ears. But nobody considered his true character. But even after he murdered every last one of his own flesh and blood siblings, Shechem still wanted to make him there came. Now, it's self-evident that not every last citizen of Shechem agreed with the choice of Abimelech, nor participated in some mass murder, nor even wanted a king, for that matter. Yet centuries before there was even the concept of democracy, the majority often ruled. And that's what happened here. The majority ruled. The majority can exert tremendous peer pressure to twist the arms of the minority to go along with them. In tribal societies, going against the will of the majority could be a matter of keeping or losing your livelihood, your family, even your mortal life. The problem is that even though likely many within Shechem did not choose Abimelech, they went along with the crowd. They accepted his rule. We certainly read of no overt opposition to it. And as we see in this story, those who did not choose Abimelech suffered and died right alongside those who did. From a spiritual standpoint, perhaps some of those who objected will receive divine pardon. But from an earthly standpoint, there would be no distinction. All would share in the fate of that nation's choice of leadership and the results of that leader's decisions. People born under a king or some kind of dictatorial ruler have little or no choice in the matter of national leadership. But as we've seen in the Bible and in secular history, it matters not. The innocent usually die right alongside the wicked. Those who have true freedom to choose their leaders, like we do in America and in several Western democracies, therefore carry the utmost responsibility for not only the choice of our leaders, but then their decisions and actions. See, we're not able to choose a leader and then just divorce ourselves from his policies and actions, even though in many cases we might like to do so. Never in history has there been a freer, more open, non-threatening system of choosing national leadership than right here in America. We also have legal means to remove leaders who've deceived us. And I can tell you with absolute confidence that we as individual citizens of America and we as believers in Messiah Yeshua who live and vote in America, we bear more responsibility for before God for our leaders and their choices than for any population that has ever existed in the history of mankind. We bear it. So we had better look beyond a candidate's lofty rhetoric, promises, campaign slogans, an endless series of 8-point plans, and our current leaders' inability to be interested in anything more than their own personal power agendas. Because we all bear a common consequence for his or her decisions made on our behalf. In the end, that leader's harmony with God, an understanding of who God is, their personal history, personal ambitions, personal moral compass, and especially in our day, his stance on Israel's right to their own land is going to determine whether we've made a wise national choice or just a suicidal one. Shechem ceased to exist as a national entity for a long time after they so unwisely chose the amoral and ungodly Abimelech to rule over them. I'm going to tell you again, history is cyclical, and we today are reliving the era of the judges. Verse 22 explains that for 3 years, the Shechemites continued to follow Abimelech, as he desired, despite Yotam's warnings. And now the judgment of God that had been patiently in abeyance begins to descend. The timing was God's, not man's, even though the men of Shechem were totally unaware of it. The Lord planted seeds of discord between the citizens of Shechem and their chosen king by sending a literal evil spirit, a demon, to excite their evil inclinations. Abimelech had chosen Arumah as his personal place of residence and placed a hand-picked governor to rule in his stead over the city of Shechem. Zebul lived in Shechem. He guided the city, and he made regular reports to his boss, Abimelech. That Abimelech chose to live elsewhere was the greatest insult to those people who had even made his reign possible. His very own family lived in Shechem, put their own reputations on the line to get Abimelech coronated. And you can be sure there was an implied understanding that there at Shechem, that would be the seat of his government over whatever size of his kingdom it was. But after 3 years, the people of Shechem caught on to Abimelech and realized that only his personal agenda for power mattered to him. They were just a means to an end. These people, who were hardly particularly morally or just themselves, made plans to counter Abimelech's efforts as a first step towards deposing him. And among those plans was the one that stated in verse 25, where they stationed liars in wait in the mountaintops above Shechem. In other words, they put some willing men upon the twin hills of Ebal and Gerizim so that they could look down upon the main trade highways running through Shechem that connected the east with the west and the north with the south and robbed the caravans. Not only did this give these robbers a boost in their personal incomes, it caused a great deal of trouble for Abimelech. That was the intent of them doing that. See, the kings of this era forced taxes and tolls from the traders and the merchants who traveled the trade routes that ran through their territories. And part of the reason these traders agreed to pay these tolls was that they were to receive the king's protection from thieves and from nomads. If the local king failed in providing security and the thievery got too out of hand, traders would avoid the area and the king would lose a major source of funding for his treasury. Abimelech soon learned of this. He understood immediately what was happening, and so the stage was set for a showdown. Well, about the same time, a new character enters the scene. His name is Gaal, son of Ebed. Now, without doubt, this was not the man's real name. Actually, it was a rather nasty epithet or nickname, because that he had become known by at some later date, because it means the abhorred son of a slave. That's not something you'd probably want to name your children. Well, this Gaal led a band of men who bore no allegiance to any particular tribe or king. Rather, they were like pirates or privateers that would ride into an area that they thought they could control and they'd take charge over it. Or they perhaps were like a hired mercenary army, and they would do the bidding of a king or a group of people if there's sufficient gain in it for themselves. Well, under Jehovah's providential guidance, this group of thugs arrives at Shechem at the time of the grape harvest and the accompanying festival. And since we now understand the rather amoral character of the residents of Shechem, Gaal and his bunch just fit right in. And the townspeople trusted Gaal. They liked him. So Gaal showed up at a very auspicious time. the great New Year event of the pagan Mystery Babylon religions. And the main event of this celebration was the gathering of grapes and fermenting them into their juice into wine, and then having this big, long, drunken party in honor of Baal. Its counterpart in Israel, of course, was Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. In fact, when we look at the original Hebrew in verse 27, where it says in English that they went into the house of their God to eat, drink, and make merry, depending on your translation, what it actually says is that they went into their house of God to give him hilulim. This means praise offerings. And it's directly connected to the Hebrew word hallel, which just means praise. And hallel is central to the Feast of Tabernacles. So here we have words reserved for describing the singing of praises to Yahweh, but instead, these words are being used to sing praises to Baal. So under the influence of the Canaanites, the Feast of Sukkot got melded with the pagan New Year's wine fest and became nothing but a time of overindulgence, decadence, and it lost all of its spiritual meaning. Any of this sound familiar? We're not far from the holiday season when Christians choose to commemorate the birth of our Savior, which, by the way, is a worthy occasion of remembrance, to be sure. But it has been so heavily influenced by secular ways to the point, at least outwardly, to the majority of our population, it's simply party time with no spiritual meaning at all. Fir trees and ornaments, lavish parties, Santa Claus and a reindeer, Frosty the Snowman, going into debt to buy unneeded but desired material possessions, all of this melded with praising God for sending his Messiah. How very strange and how very sad. There is not one meaningful shred of difference between how our Messiah's advent is celebrated today by most of his followers and what we're witnessing in verse 27 of Judges chapter 9. It's the same thing. Because the Israelites represented the majority population of Shechem, and they felt perfectly justified in adopting these completely pagan practices in lieu of the God-ordained ones that Moses gave to them. Man, that's a valuable lesson we really need to act upon. So at this time of feasting and drinking, Gaal used the moment to challenge the people of Shechem to openly revolt against Abimelech. And he says, who is this Abimelech that we should bow down to him? I mean, after all, Abimelech is nothing more than a son of Yerubbaal. Now remember, Yerubbaal is a nickname for Gideon, and it means Baal fighter. And here the people of Shechem, Hebrew and Canaanite, were having this drunken bash in honor of Baal. And Gaal says, why should we have a king over us who is the son of a man who hates Baal and broke down his altar? And Gaal goes on to say that if they're to have a ruler, he ought to be from Hamor, the father of Shechem. Now remember, Hamor was a Hivite king who was the actual founder of the city of Shechem. So now, whereas Abimelech used his Canaanite, or really Hivite, blood as a reason for the people of Shechem to invite him to be their king, so now Gaal is reminding the people, but he's also half Hebrew. So Gaal is using his Hebrew bloodlines against him. Oh man, what a tangled web we weave, huh? Then Gaal throws out a not so hidden hint. Well, if I were to control this people, I'd get rid of that guy Abimelech. In other words, if you agree to help me dispose of Abimelech, I'll become your leader. Well, then in his inebriated state, he throws down the gauntlet to Abimelech and challenges him to come to Shechem with whatever loyal army he has and fight. Well, when Zebul, who was the governor of Shechem, now remember this guy is loyal to Abimelech, hears about this, he sends a message to Abimelech of this pending revolt. So that Zebul was able to continue on in the face of this growing and unhidden rebellious mindset speaks to the divided nature of Shechem. Just as there was no consensus in choosing Abimelech 3 years earlier, there's no consensus in revolting against him now. So Zebul suggests to Abimelech that he get his army together, come to Shechem under the cover of darkness, and then lie in wait out in the fields that surround the city. And when dawn breaks, he should attack. Gaal's men are bound to respond in kind, and then by drawing them out in the open from behind the city walls, if Abimelech is properly prepared, he should be able to defeat Gaal. Abimelech acted in accordance with Gaal's advice. So in the morning, Zebul and Gaal were standing inside the city gate, both for different reasons, no doubt, looking to see if Abimelech was anywhere to be seen. Now, obviously, Gaal did not know that Zebul had sent for Abimelech. Well, when Gaal saw Abimelech's men moving around on the mountainside, with the morning light still dim and the shadows still being long, Zebul tried to convince him, you're just seeing things. Just to give Abimelech's men time get a little bit closer before they were discovered. But when it simply wasn't possible to conceal the plan any longer, Zebul turns and he flung Gaal's boastful comment right back into his face. "Where's your mouth now?" he says to him. Well, now Zebul turns the tables and he provokes Gaal to leave the safety of these thick defensive walls of Shechem to go out and take on the man that he had so little regard for. No details are given of the battle, just the outcome. As it says in verse 40, "But Abimelech gave chase, Gaal took flight. Many fell wounded, they were strewn all along the way to the city gate. Abimelech went back to Arumah, left Zebul to drive out what few members of Gaal's gang remained inside of Shechem. And now with Gaal banished from Shechem, Abimelech could do as he pleased and bringing full destruction to those who rebelled against him. So the morning after the last of Gaal's men were expelled, the regular townsfolk of Shechem went out of the city gates to tend to their fields, figuring that all this fighting was over, so let's just get back to normal life. Wrong. Abimelech and his men were lying in wait to take revenge. And as soon as the Shechemites left the city and went into the fields, they were deep into their hoeing and pruning and harvesting, the attack came. And Abimelech used the rather standard battle tactic of dividing his men into three groups. The one he led immediately headed to the city gates, where he secured the entrance into the city, and by doing this, the townsfolk, who are now caught out into the field, have nowhere to run. They were slaughtered in their fields. And then when this wanton act was completed, Abimelech led his troops inside the city to begin destruction inside there. The text says that the fighting and the destruction went on all day, and he effected a rather senseless slaughter of all the inhabitants of Shechem, destroyed all the buildings, sowed all the land with salt. Sowing the land with salt is not literal, although it may have been ceremonial. It simply means that the land in the city became a wasteland, unusable. Well, now, as happens in an aristocracy, while the common folk were out there fighting and dying, the upper class, who lived in another area of the city, made a mad dash to a place that had been built for their special protection. They fled from their normal quarters inside the city to the fortress temple of their god, here called El Berit, meaning covenant with El. Now, El was the Canaanite word for highest god, usually considered to even be above Baal. Now, of course, we find that the Hebrews borrowed that word, El, to refer to Jehovah early on in the Bible. And while the move from inside the city was obvious because the lords of Shechem and their families felt the temple fortress was probably the strongest building now available to them, without doubt, the main reason they went in there was the hope that their god, El, would protect them. Well, when Abimelech observed all of this, he took countermeasures. So he led his men to a nearby hill that had this dense growth of trees, fir trees, actually. So he and his men chopped off some branches. They brought them to this temple tower, now packed with all the upper crust of Shechem, and they laid their branches against it, and they lit them on fire. The greenness of the branches would have made for horrific choking smoke while it burned through the wooden door and wooden roof that was standard in that time, killing many where they sat huddled together, driving others out just to be struck down. It says over 1,000 men and women were killed at the base of El's temple. Well, with the central city of Shechem now in ruins, Abimelech moved against the neighboring city of Thebes, or Thebes, depends on how you want to pronounce it, that lay about 9 miles northeast of Shechem. And this was apparently the city had acted in sympathy, or at least Abimelech thought so, with the people of Shechem. Well, the central part of the city of Thebes was taken rapidly, and many of the city people, not just the aristocracy like in Shechem, fled to the refuge of what is called a fortified tower. Never one to waste a successful tactic, Abimelech used fire to force those who took refuge in the tower to come out. But this time there was a different result. As Abimelech approached the side of the tower to take hateful revenge by personally setting the branches laid against it on fire, a woman on the roof of the tower flung an upper millstone over the edge, striking Abimelech on his head and crushing his skull. Now, an upper millstone in those days was about 15 inches in diameter, maybe 3 or 4 inches thick. It would have weighed at least 20 pounds. Strong woman. Well, it must have struck a glancing blow, because if it had hit his cranium bluntly, he would have died instantly. However, he was aware enough to know it was a woman who had done him in. And this just disturbed him badly. So he asked his armor bearer to run him through so that he wouldn't have to suffer what was seen as the humiliation of having been killed by a woman in battle. So verses 56 and 57 need to leave an indelible mark on our memories. God pays back. Perhaps we as his followers are not to pay back, but God does. God repaid Abimelech and the men of Shechem for all the wrong they had done. If God does not pay back, think about this, if he doesn't, then his justice system is a farce. What is justice? Is if there's no punishment for a crime? There's no such thing as justice anymore. Paul brings that exact principle forth in Galatians 6. Galatians 6, 7. Don't delude yourselves. No one makes a fool of God. A person reaps what he sows. God's law of retribution is not going to be foiled. You know, it may not even happen in this world, but it'll happen in the next. Let's move on to chapter 10 of Judges. Judges chapter 10. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it starts on page 283. It's not a very long chapter. After Abimelech, there arose to save Israel Tola, the son of Puah, the son of Dodo, from the tribe of Issachar. He lived in Shamir, in the hills of Ephraim. He judged Israel 23 years, and when he died, he was buried in Shamir. After him arose Yair from Gilead. He judged Israel 22 years. He had 30 sons who rode on 30 young donkeys. They owned 30 cities, which are called Havot Yair to this day. They are in the territory of Gilead. When Yair died, he was buried in Kamon. Again, the people of Israel did what was evil from Adonai's perspective, and they served the Baals, the Ashtaroth, the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the people of Ammon, the gods of the Philistines. They abandoned Adonai. They did not serve him. So the anger of Adonai blazed against Israel, and he handed them over to the Philistines and the people of Ammon. For 18 years, starting that year, they oppressed and persecuted all the people of Israel who lived beyond the Jordan in the territory of the Amorim in Gilead. And the people of Ammon also crossed the Jordan to fight Judah, Benjamin, and the house of Ephraim. So that Israel was greatly distressed. Then the people of Israel cried out to Adonai, "We have sinned against you by forsaking our God and serving the Baals." Adonai said to the people of Israel, "I saved you from the Egyptians, the Amorim, the people of Ammon, and the Philistim, didn't I? Likewise, when the people of Sidon, Amalek, and Maon pressed you, you cried out to me, and I rescued you from their power. Yet you abandoned me. And you served other gods. Therefore, I will not rescue you anymore. Go, cry to those gods you chose. Let them rescue you when you're in trouble." The people of Israel said to Adonai, "We have sinned. Treat us in whatever way seems good to you, but save us today, please." They got rid of their foreign gods, and they served Adonai, and he became troubled by Israel's misery. Then the people of Ammon gathered together and set up camp at Gilead, while the people of Israel assembled and camped at Mizpah. The people, the chiefs of Gilead, said to each other, "Whoever leads the battle against the army of Ammon will be head over everyone living in Gilead." As a preface to this short chapter, I want to mention that by all rights, we probably ought to pause and study the book of Ruth at this point. Because this is about the time in history that the story of Ruth occurs, right now. Although it may have been as early as towards the end of Gideon's life, but right in that range. That's right, Ruth's adventures took place during the time of the judges, during the time of what we're reading about. Before Samson came onto the scene. But for the sake of continuity, we're going to stay in the book of Judges, and that's then, if you want to, you can go study the book of Ruth when we're done with Judges. I think it'd be a good thing for you to do. Anyway, chapter 10 begins by briefly introducing us to two of the five so-called minor judges, Tola and Yair. Now this is really, there's really very little detail about either one of them. We are told that Tola arose to save Israel, but that's about it. He ruled him as a ruled over them as a judge for 23 years. He was from the tribe of Issachar, but he lived in there, interestingly enough, in the hills of Ephraim. In other words, he did not live in the territory given by allotment to Issachar. This fits with the more and more better understood geopolitical map in those days, in which Issachar only occupied a few cities and towns within their own territory, and otherwise they moved into and shared places in their brethren's territories. The reason for this is simple. The Canaanites that occupied their allotted land were just too strong for them to dislodge. Tola resided in the general area where Abimelech operated, so that he arose to save Israel. Could have had something to do with dealing with the aftermath of the Abimelech debacle. I will admit that's my speculation. Jair in English, is only identified as being from Gilead. No family heritage is given. Some people think he was of the tribe of Manasseh, but that's only because Gilead was in the area of the half of Manasseh that operated on the east side of the Jordan River. We have to be real careful with these identities, especially at this time in Israel's history. Much intermarriage among Israelite tribes had already taken place. Much movement of families and whole clans from their allotted territory into another had also occurred by now. Being from Gilead could mean he's from the tribe of Gad, simply that his family or whatever tribe was living in Gilead, and therefore is identified more by where he lived than what tribe he belonged to. What we do know is that Jair came from a high social status. He judged his area for 22 years, just one less than Tola before him, and that he held sway over 30 cities, each one of them run by one of his 30 sons. If he had 30 sons, he would have had at least as many daughters, meaning he had many wives. This also means he lived as royalty, and that is further confirmed by the statement that his 30 sons rode on 30 ass colts, is how it actually reads. Asses were highly esteemed in that era as riding animals, and often they carried special recognition. So we have here a well-known and large royal family. Even though the patriarch Jair was only officially known as a shofet, a judge, but not as a king. Now this small mention of Jair and his royal lifestyle gives us every reason to believe that he followed in the kingly lifestyle he observed in Gideon and his sons, and then fully brought into play as overt royalty by Abimelech. This ought to help us see the significant sea change that occurred with Gideon when he elevated himself into a status and a lifestyle well beyond any judge before him. And of course, this was prodded along by those who Gideon had delivered, pleading with him to assume the role as their king. He refused to take on the title of king, but it is self-evident he easily accepted the trappings of royalty. Jair, therefore, had a precedent, and likely he was also asked to be king. Well, Jair was the first shofet to operate in the Transjordan, that is, on the east side of the Jordan River. There were many fewer Hebrew people on the east side of the river, and generally they were more isolated from the Baal worship centers that were more concentrated in Canaan, where the 9.5 tribes lived. Very probably, the 2.5 Israelite tribes who took up residence on the east side of the Jordan River had considerably less temptation to fall into idolatry than their brethren on the west bank. Yet the mere fact that Jair was raised up as a judge says that idolatry eventually came to the Transjordanian Hebrews. We know that during Jair's time, there was no oppression going on from a foreign enemy. So the trouble that Jair dealt with was strictly in-house, so to speak. The Midianites had passed through this region, but they didn't stay and they didn't conquer it. So as I mentioned early on, each judge had different conditions to deal with than any of the others. And so it's very difficult to give a standardized definition of a judge or what they did or what they were supposed to do. And we're going to especially see that when we talk about Samson. And we'll continue in Judges 10 next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.